Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You're listening to the Co-Main Event Podcast. And now your hosts, Ben Folks and Chad Dundas.
That's right, you're listening to another episode of the Co-Main Event Mixed Martial Arts Podcast. I'm Chad Dundas, that's Ben Folks. We're both longtime MMA journalists, and for the last 9 years, we've been meeting here every week to break down all the action in the wild, weird, and occasionally wonderful world of mixed martial arts. Ben, we're going to do an all-questions-considered episode of the podcast this week. That means featuring from start to finish listener mail from the beloved listeners of the Co-Main Event Podcast. Before we get into that, though, we did want to spare some time at the beginning of the show to talk about the two main event fights from Bellator and the UFC over the weekend, since the rest of the show will be a bit of a grab bag. But before that, we wanted to shout out our guy Chris Rinney, longtime listener of the Co-Main Event Podcast and beloved patron of the Co-Main Event Podcast, talented artist Chris Rinney, who has a new book coming out, Volume 2, in his works here, The Fine Art of Violence. And we both got to look at an advanced copy of this one, and we saw The Fine Art of Violence Volume 1 when it came out. And I don't know, man, Chris Rinney, one of the best out there working, good guy, amazing artist. The people should check out his work.
Yeah, I was looking through it earlier today. Some good stuff in there, man. Good work there. Even there's a, I don't want to call it quite a caricature drawing, but a drawing of MMA photographer Esther Lin, where it feels like you've captured something, my friend. You've captured an essence of the person. Well done.
So if you like fights and you like art, you might want to check out Chris's work. Like I said, one of the best guys out there working. So check out The Fine Art of Violence, Volume 2. All right, let's get into this thing here. We got a lot of ground to cover, a lot of messages from the listeners out there to get through. Friday night, Ben, we had Bellator 259 coming to us from the Mohegan Sun Arena out there at the granddaddy of them all, Uncasville, Connecticut, headlined by Chris Cyborg against Leslie Smith for the women's featherweight title. Chris Cyborg wins this one with a TKO during the last 10 seconds of a 25-minute, five-round fight. She really batters Leslie Smith from start to finish here. We had a discussion on Friday during the Power Hour about Chris Cyborg's incredible longevity, essentially as, you know, one, if not the top female fighter in the world for essentially an uninterrupted decade, and her ability to, I guess, grow and change with the times was kind of on display during this fight, because you have 35-year-old Chris Cyborg out there, really showing a lot of evolution as far as I'm concerned in terms of how she approaches the game. Obviously, the tenacity is still there. The punching power is still there. The aggressiveness is still there. but it's a little bit tempered now, and she is perfectly content to go out there and kind of pick you apart with straight punches. And also, in this fight against Leslie Smith, work in a whole bunch of different kinds of takedowns that that were nice and got the fight where she wanted to be in the moment. And of course, she wins with the late TKO. What can you say about a 35-year-old version of Chris Cyborg, who has spent her career atop the mountain of women's MMA? And at this point, you know, at a time when a lot of athletes would probably be slowing down, looks like she has found a way to continue not only to be competitive, but to be dominating, and, you know, may well be poised to be the Bellator women's featherweight champion essentially for as long as she wants to be.
Yeah. She doesn't go out there and fight anymore like she needs to get rid of you right away.
Yeah.
She fights like she's not really concerned. She got nowhere special she's got to be, and she's just going to take her time and do this thing as well and as thoroughly as she needs to do it. And you're right that when you're looking at all the stuff that she can do now, and if you're trying to come up with a game plan of how you're going to beat Cyborg, I guess if you can't just draw up your perfect fighter and say, okay, be faster and stronger than she is and have better one punch power or just an incredible chin, I don't know what you come up with just athletically and game plan wise to beat Chris Cyborg with. There's just not a whole lot of people out there who can do it. And yeah, then especially if you're thinking about, there's, as we've talked about before, in the bigger weight classes in the women's divisions, like 145 and up, there's not a ton of talent to choose from. When you split them between Bellator and the UFC, it seems like you're putting a big fish in an even smaller pond.
Yeah, that's one of the things about Chris Cyborg, I guess, that her detractors would point to throughout the highlights of her career. And not only did she test positive for steroids back in 2011 in the wake of her last fight in Strikeforce and served a suspension for that, but at times, especially in the Elite XC and maybe now in the Bellator days, there's been times when it seemed like she was having fights against people who were brought in basically as showcase opponents for Cyborg, basically for Cyborg to beat them up on television and make Cyborg look extremely dominating. At the same time, though, as we talked about on Friday during the Power Hour, she also fought pretty much all of the best opposition that was available to her in and around her weight class throughout her entire career. Gina Carano, Marluce Kunin twice, Charmaine Tweet, Leslie Smith twice now, Lena Landsberg, Tanya Evinger, Holly Holm, obviously the loss to Amanda Nunes at UFC 232, which is the other thing you can look to as a drawback, I guess, in the career of Chris Cyborg. But then Felicia Spencer, Julia Budd, and now Leslie Smith, the last three of her fights, of course, coming in Bellator. I don't know. You look at Cyborg, she's clearly a draw. She's clearly an attraction. People like to watch her fight. You'd have to guess there would be a Kat Zingano bout coming up here in Bellator in her immediate future. How do you think she should be regarded, not only in terms of legacy, but also the position that she holds in the sport today as this, you know, Bellator featherweight champion in an organization that's just vying for eyeballs and in a division that is not crowded with the greatest talent out there?
Yeah, it does seem like there's some limited things here and there that you can build to, and the Kat Zingano fight seems like that's going to be the next one. And that, you know, I imagine Bellator can work up some pretty good hype for that one if they really put their shoulders into it. But I think when we do look back on Chris Cyborg's legacy, whenever it ends, I mean, for Christ's sake, if you tell me Chris Cyborg is doing this for 10 more years, I absolutely believe you. I think that the thing that will really stand out to us is the dominance over such a long period of time, like the longevity and how good she was and how she managed to just completely decimate some of these divisions and some of the rosters that she was faced with, how thoroughly for just how many years. Because we talked about it before with a few other male fighters where she has spanned different eras, especially of women's MMA. That old like Elite XC Gina Carano era, she was the dominant force then, and then she was the dominant force up until she met Amanda Nunes in the UFC, now dominating Bellator, and she's still really, really good. just on a technical level, just watching her fight, you go, that person is really, really good at fighting.
Yeah.
And there aren't many people who can do it for that long and be that good at it.
Yeah, it's hard to think of anyone else in the landscape of the sport who has been as dominant as Chris Cyborg over such a long period of time, more than a decade, really. And as you mentioned, dominant throughout several different phases of the evolution of the sport around her. And at the same time, like, you look at the criticisms that you could make of her, and you can also make many of those same criticisms about the top male fighters, especially from those time periods, whether it be performance-enhancing drug scandals or not fighting people that you feel like represent the cream of the crop. And Cyborg just kind of continues to cruise along and at times seemingly be sort of unfairly maligned just in terms of the weight of the criticism, right? I feel like Chris Cyborg has encountered more and more bitter criticism for her drawbacks than a lot of her male counterparts who would be in the same position. And I think that's unfortunate, but has been a reality of the evolution of women's MMA. And Chris Cyborg has been out in front of it and one of the people who has gotten a lot of the harshest and at times most unfair criticism. And I don't know, man, to see her out there at this stage in the game, still essentially overwhelming people like Leslie Smith, still carrying a major title in a major organization, still essentially taking on all comers, anyone that her current promoter can find for her to fight. I don't think you could ever make the case that Cyborg ducked or avoided anyone. And so It's pretty amazing, man, to see her continue to work that magic and work that game, and an evolving game, like I said, at this stage in her career. It's pretty incredible.
You know, the one bone I have to pick with Showtime's, you know, Bellator stuff right now so far is that I'm going in there and I'm trying to watch it on the streaming app.
Yeah.
That's how I subscribe to Showtime. Going in there on my smart TV, opening up the Showtime app. I want to find a way to tell it, like, hey, look, man, if there's a Bellator on tonight, show me that Bellator first thing. Like, that's what I came here for. I don't need to be attacked by my own viewing history on the Showtime app, which is what's happening right now, Chad. I don't need to be reminded when I'm trying to go in there and I'm trying to watch Chris Cyborg and Leslie Smith. You don't need to make a big deal out of it, Showtime, that the last two things I watched late at night were the movie Rad, the 1980s BMX film Rad, and an episode like 12 minutes of an episode of Gigolos. You don't need to just throw that in my face, Showtime. Give me the Bellator stuff. You know that's why I'm here. It's not 2 a.m. Okay. I'm not trying to watch Rad again.
It sounds to me like you are living in a prison of your own making. Like, you want the Showtime streaming app to read your mind and be like, oh, just, Bellator's look on. This is what Ben is going to want to watch.
Yes.
We're talking about a computer algorithm here, my friend. It's not sitting next to you on the couch. It doesn't know what you want to watch at that moment. As far as it knows, you want to watch all of the 80s BMX bike movies that they got in the library.
If it's 1:30 a.m., then fine. Then that's when you, Showtime app, can say to me, would you like to watch the next episode of Gigolos? Do you want to see what those gigolos get up to? Are they going to do any kind of thing where they have like a zany experience with fake tanning, but then also have to seduce a wealthy heiress later that night? Then that's the time for that. If it's, you know, Bellator time on a Friday night, give me the Bellator.
You're just asking a lot. We have the technology, Chad. You're asking a lot, is all I'm saying.
We're living in the future.
All right. Well, on Saturday night, we had the UFC down there at the Apex Arena. Kind of a low-key card, if you will. But Rob Font, in the main event, gets a unanimous decision victory over Cody Garbrandt in an important men's bantamweight contender fight, I guess. For Garbrandt, Ben, this was the first time we had seen him in nearly a year. And he had some pretty highly publicized struggles with long-term complications from COVID-19. He had pneumonia. He had an issue where he couldn't train. He was suffering from some vertigo. And, you know, I want to talk about Rob Font. Don't want to take anything away from his win that I think sets him up to be a contender here moving forward. But you really get the impression when you watch this fight that it is a tough order for Cody Garbs to come in with that much inactivity and that much illness. And I guess we can't know for sure how much or how little the COVID-19 stuff affected his performance in the cage. But it would have been rough to come in after almost a year off without any debilitating illness and fight a contender at the level of Rob Font. And I think you really saw that difficulty all over Cody Garbrandt throughout this fight, because he started strong, and then Rob Font seemed to figure him out a little bit, and then Garbrandt really seemed to struggle throughout, basically from the second round on through this thing, and got extremely high on the Coleman Index, turned absolutely bright pink very early in the fight, gets battered throughout the rest of it, and ultimately suffers the loss here. It just seemed like a lot for Cody Garbrandt to have to deal with in this fight. Not only the inactivity, but also maybe not being able to train over a long period of time the way he is accustomed to. And then coming in against a guy as sharp and talented as Rob Font was just a too tall of an order here for the comeback fight for the former champion.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't think that you talk about him turning bright pink. I think a lot of that is just because he's being pasted in the face over and over again by crisp striker. Well, yeah, I mean, he's... I think that's a lot of that is that he's getting beat up and he's getting tired because he's trying to find a way to turn that around and just keeps getting thumped on. But I do agree that, you know, Michael Bisping mentioned it at some point during the commentary, and
shout out to Michael Bisping for bringing that up during the UFC broadcast when a couple of weeks ago Dana White essentially came out and said that UFC commentators are either encouraged or flat out told to not talk about the pandemic. So good on Michael Bisping for bringing up one of the most pertinent storylines for this fight. I'm glad we didn't go through the whole thing and just pretend like that hadn't happened.
Right. And it did not feel like in the lead up to it that at least the UFC was super interested in spending a whole lot of time highlighting that Cody Garbrandt had been dealing with that. I mean, obviously it came up, you know, as he's talking to the media beforehand and everything, but it did feel like kind of a jarring switch. And I don't know if it was just that's Michael Bisping going rogue because he knew this is a legitimate thing that needs to be discussed and needs to be put out there, or if maybe that restriction has loosened a little bit now that it feels like, okay, we're exiting this pandemic. We can have live events with fans again, and we don't have to worry about it so much. Go ahead and talk about it when it feels relevant to what's going on. And it definitely feels relevant here because, you know, he I think Michael Bisping did a good job with it because he was like, I'm not trying to take away from Rob Font here. I'm not saying this is the only reason for what we're seeing. But that definitely, it was not that long ago. I mean, it was in December we were still talking about stuff that Cody Garbrandt was dealing with, that he's dealing with blood clot stuff, vertigo stuff. You know, when he talks about it, he tells you, like, it seemed like it was pretty serious and really, really going to impact your ability to do anything. And then to be able to get back in there, get back in shape, and come in and fight a guy as good as Rob Font, where if your timing's a little bit off, that guy can really exploit it. And it seemed like that, like Cody Garbrandt was in a situation, especially later in this fight, where he was really trying to rely on, like, let me see if I can get this guy to walk into a big shot. And Rob Font had that shit scouted, man. You see Cody Garbrandt get up against that fence, start to dip down with that right hand like he's just like trying to power up the knockout blow like he did, you know. And you could see Rob Font look at him and be like, no, you know what? I'm going to walk back here to the middle of the cage. I invite you to join me. Come on over here. I'm not going to walk into that like Hammer of the Gods kind of situation. And it seemed like, okay, Cody Garbrandt early on realized, maybe I have a little bit of a wrestling advantage over this guy. Like he had said apparently to the commentators beforehand that he planned to wrestle him some. Wrestles him some in the first round, takes him down early in the second round, and then it's like Rob Font figured that shit out too. And credit to him for making really good adjustments and coming in there with a clear game plan. Like, I want to jab him. I want to pick him apart with better, faster, crisper striking, but I don't want to stand there and trade power shots and trade hooks in close with Cody Garbrandt. And then being able to adjust to a little bit more of a wrestling game plan when he saw it. Like, that's a really good performance from Rob Font. It's also asking a whole hell of a lot of Cody Garbrandt to come right back in after all that. And first fight back, you fight, you know, the number three bantamweight in the world.
Yeah. And for Rob Font, he's won four fights in a row now, five of his last six. These last two, a TKO over Marlon Moraes back in December, and now this pretty dominant unanimous decision win over Cody Garbrandt at this Fight Night event would seem to set him up as a top contender. I'm going to segue here into our first listener mail question from Sean Diggity McIntosh, who writes, "Hey there, knuckleheads," which seems uncalled for. Then he says, "Let's
but not
get right,
inaccurate, you know,
not inaccurate, but maybe uncalled for. Let's get straight to the point. Who do you see holding the bantamweight strap at this time next year? Sterling, Yan, Sandhagen, Dillashaw, or Font?" It's a wide open division right now, seemingly to me. You've got Aljamain Sterling obviously holding the title after that fight where Petr Yan cheated so bad they had to take the title away from him. And now Aljamain Sterling has opted for some surgery that he had been putting off. So it sounds like it's going to be a little while at least before he returns. Depending on what Aljamain Sterling's timeline is, Ben, I'm not sure that I would be terribly surprised to see an interim title happen at some point in this division. A lot of that obviously will depend on Sterling and his ability and willingness to get back in the cage. But I think you have at least a decent chance at some point in the near future of having a unification fight here, I would think, between an interim champion, perhaps in Petr Yan, and the undisputed champion at Aljamain Sterling. And whoever emerged with that belt, where you go from there, I think, honestly, is anybody's best guess. But heartening to see this many top contenders, a bunch of 135 pound guys all circling the title. No matter what happens, it's going to be fun.
Yeah, and all those fights that you could make right there seem like they're going to be fun. But it does highlight the difficult spot that Rob Font is in right now, because I think coming into this, I think he was sitting at number three at 135 pounds in the UFC. And now it's like the guys ahead of him, I think it's like Sandhagen, Petr Yan, and then the champion, Aljamain Sterling. You got to think, if Aljamain Sterling's timeline to come back is at any time soon, he and Petr Yan probably going to do it again. Corey Sandhagen already has, you know, at least we're trying to reschedule that fight with TJ Dillashaw last. I don't know if we got a firm date on that one yet when it's rescheduled for. But it puts Rob Font in a situation where if he's going to fight somebody and he can't just sit around forever waiting for an opportunity, he has to fight someone down the rankings. And he's already beaten several of those people down the rankings from him. One idea I heard thrown around a little bit was like, hey, what about somebody like Dominic Cruz, where he has a name? He's looking to get back in the picture. If you're Dominic Cruz, you might be thinking, hey, if Rob Font's way up there, if I can come in there and beat him, then I'm immediately in that title conversation again and don't have to, you know, try to work my way back up the ladder one rung at a time. So you can see how it makes sense for both people. But, if you ask me to guess, like, who is going to be the champ this time next year, still my best guess is Petr Yan. Because, you mentioned it. He cheated so bad they had to take the title away from him. But he was looking pretty good in a lot of ways against Aljamain Sterling in that fight. I think he matches up pretty well against everybody here. As long as he can keep from cheating his ass off. And cheating, you know, in a way that's so, that, you know, not regular cheating. Not right. Like Dundasso, you can get away with it and we'll shake our finger and say like, naughty Peter kind of at you. But like the kind of cheating that'll get you straight up disqualified. If you can avoid that, I think he beats most of these people.
Yeah. Next question this week comes to us from Adolf Coors.
Oh, good. So, good to hear from him.
Yep. Spare a couple minutes for Jack. Oh, you growing a beard now. Damn son, Hermanson. So that's a long one. That's a ponderous nickname for Jack Hermanson. Nonetheless,
I mean, he's not grown it. He has done growed it in.
He emerges with the unanimous decision win over Edmund Shahbazyan. This is in the middleweight curtain jerker here, the main card on ESPN+. Now, see, Ben, I thought that this was a little bit of a weird one for Edmund Shahbazyan, who had been an undefeated top prospect at 11-0, closing out 2019. And then I think we all kind of thought had bitten off more than he could chew, or at least matchmakers had given him a bit more than he could chew against Derek Brunson in August of last year. Then he's got damn near 9 months off here. Like I think a lot of people you've seen during this pandemic having sort of an extended period where they didn't fight or couldn't fight or whatever, to come in against a guy the caliber of Jack Hermanson here in this event is a little bit of a strange course to try to get the previous top prospect back on track, because now you got a situation where Edmund Shahbazyan has suffered back-to-back losses. And, you know, still a very young guy, obviously at 23 years old, so still has plenty of time to get things back together. And it's not like this is, by any stretch of the imagination, the end of the road for him or anything like that. But if I were an Edmund Shahbazyan handler, I would have thought it would have been better to not have two back-to-back losses.
Yeah.
Some of my acute strategizing there that I'm mm-hmm. known for, better not mm-hmm. to lose back-to-back fights. Yeah. But I don't know, man. Jack Hermanson, a tough draw, I think, for Edmund Shahbazyan, even though Hermanson comes in off the loss over Marvin Vettori. At this point, Hermanson has won 2 of 3. But yeah, if I might have chosen a different path had I been Edmund Shahbazyan or one of his managers at this point. This just seemed like a tough fight for him.
Yeah, and I guess maybe the thinking here was, we want him to be a thing, get him right back into that sort of conversation by putting him up against a guy, like a known guy in the division and a guy who's hanging around contender status in the division. And I could see how matchup-wise, you know, in the first round, you see when Edmund Shahbazyan is moving around and popping out those crisp punching combos, you're like, man, okay, that guy has got some legit skills, and he's quick. Hermanson really seemed to struggle with his speed early on. But, you know, and I'm not going to say like it's a terrible ground game or anything, but you get into these grappling exchanges against Jack Hermanson. Like, he had some, like, let me get out of absolute dire trouble escapability. But when Hermanson kind of figured that out and was like, okay, I'm not going to fuck around anymore trying to take your back and choke you or trying to go to full mount and finish you, I'm going to just spend some time holding you down in half guard, he didn't have a whole lot of answers for that. And that right now, you got to know people are going to look at you and think that the book is out. Like, get through the first round with this guy, take him down, wear him down, wear him out, and that's how you can beat him. And people are going to be trying to do that until you show that you can stop it. Like we've talked about with other people like Kevin Holland. Like, once somebody does it to you once, be prepared for other people, especially if they struggle with the thing you do really well. They're going to try and do that other thing. They're going to try to follow that same blueprint. And it does seem like, especially because you mentioned Edmund Shahbazyan only 23 and also has, like, Jack Hermanson has more than twice as many pro fights as Edmund Shahbazyan. And that, especially if you get into the second and third rounds and fight, everybody starts to get tired and everybody's slowing down a little bit. That kind of experience is going to make a big difference. And so that is like a really tough situation to put him in, and does look like, I don't know if you thought you were doing him any favors, but you could maybe bring him along a little bit more slowly than taking him right out of that Derek Brunson fight, throwing him in a really tough one after that.
Yeah. And if you're Edmund Shahbazyan, maybe the good news is that it seems like the title picture is going to be in a bit of a log jam here for a while. You got Israel Adesanya against Marvin Vettori coming up, but then you got a whole fleet of contenders about ready to fight each other and kind of circling the title. Of course, Robert Whittaker, Paulo Costa, you know, Jared Cannonier, Darren Till, all those guys are still kind of jockeying for position. So, you know, if you are part of the Edmund Shahbazyan camp, it's not like there's any reason to rush the guy. Let's get a few fights, you know, that we feel like are good matchups that we can get this kid back on a roll. And then maybe we start looking up the ranks in the top 10 to see where we're at. As far as I'm concerned, I just don't see that there's any reason to rush him into future Jack Hermanson style matchups when you don't have to.
Yeah.
Next question this week comes to us from Michael Plater, who writes, Carla Esparza versus Weili Zhang? ? So you had Carla Esparza come out in the co-main event of this thing and get a second round TKO over Yan Zhaozhen, women's strawweight fight, and really looked impressive, frankly, with the takedowns and just some savage ground and pound from Carla Esparza. She gets her 5th straight win. And man, I tell you what, it feels like a lifetime ago that Carla Esparza won the inaugural strawweight championship on the heels of that season of The Ultimate Fighter when she beat Rose Namajunas back in 2014. And maybe Carla Esparza is the kind of athlete that we forgot about for a while.
Yeah.
While other people were dominating this division and we had some other fun stuff going on, but now you wake up and she's got 5 wins in a row. And this is an impressive one here on Saturday night. And I'll tell you what, she fights in a style that not a lot of people excel at in that division with good takedowns. And then, as you saw, you know, this weekend, able ground and pound that she can use to finish you with, which in this weight class is not something that you see every day. Wiley Zhang would be an interesting matchup, although I think a difficult one for Carla Esparza. And obviously, if you are Carla and you manage to climb all the way up to the top, you might have a different fight on your hands in terms of taking down someone like Rose Namajunas and controlling her on the ground and battering her like we saw over the weekend. But I don't know, like, kind of a feel-good story as far as I'm concerned to see this former champion in Carla Esparza, who had seemingly been so forgotten and kind of left in the dust, now come roaring back to something approaching top contender status in this division.
Yeah, I'll be the first to admit, I forgot about Carla Esparza. When I looked up and saw that she's won like 5 in a row, I was like, what? When did that happen? Where was I? Did I get up to go to the bathroom during all those fights? Like, it really snuck up on me. And yet, when you see her, especially this past weekend, you realize she has made some adjustments to stay competitive and stay relevant, that division. But she's made them in such a way that she's not gotten away from what she really does well. Like, she hasn't tried to make herself into a completely different fighter, just like a different and more adaptable version of the fighter that she's always been. And yet, when I hear people talking about, like, okay, 5 in a row, you know, and you beat somebody highly ranked in that division, is that the time you get a rematch with Rose Namajunas when you can point out, like, hey, I have a win over the current champ, let's run that one back, get something on the books. Don't you feel like, if the UFC is looking to make a rematch for Rose Namajunas for what I'm going to call business reasons, they would be more excited about making a rematch with Zhang Weili than they would with Carla Esparza?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, no doubt about it. And if those are your two options, yeah, that I don't think it's really any question at all.
Yeah. I mean, like, even like hearing Dana White talk about it afterwards, where it was like, okay, maybe we'll do this Rose Namajunas Carla Esparza thing if we have to. That felt like the vibe that I was getting from it.
Yeah, but at the same time, are you socked in a little bit here by the official rankings? Not that they are the law of the land or anything like that, but when you got 5 straight wins and you just absolutely destroyed the person ranked number 3 overall, the person above you, the only people ranked above Carla Esparza at this point, Ben, are the champion Rose Namajunas, Zhang Weili, and Joanna Jędrzejczyk. So I agree with you that Carla Esparza in some ways shapes up as a person who might have to win a couple more fights before we start thinking that they have no choice other than to book her in a rematch for the title. But you're closing in on that territory just because there ain't a lot of other places to go here for Carla Esparza.
Yeah.
Than a title shot after, I would think, another fight or two.
The nice thing about if you do see a Rose Namajunas Carla Esparza rematch is that would then give Rose Namajunas a chance. If she wins that, I believe then she would be able to say that she has beaten everybody who has ever held the UFC women's strawweight title.
Wow. Well, there you go.
I mean, lost to a couple of them, but also beaten every single one of them at least once. That's something. That's a nice feather in the old cap. You know what I'm saying?
Bet. You bet. Next question this week comes to us from, I got to go to the notes here, but this is Swedish death metal guitarist Olavi Makonen.
Okay.
Nailed it on the pronunciation. He writes, so the Philadelphia Dragon, Paul Felder, announced his retirement on Saturday night's broadcast. He had previously semi-retired after the Dan Hooker fight, but came back for that ultra short notice fight versus RDA, where he got pretty much whipped pillar to post. So I feel like this is one is more likely to stick and less likely to be a hashtag MMA retirement. Can we pour one out for our homie and discuss how his career will be remembered? I think Paul Felder is going to go down in, I guess, UFC history, which seems like a weighty thing to say, but he will be remembered as a very good lightweight, who is also a good analyst and a nice dude, and a guy who obviously never got to the very top of the mountain, but at the same time fought in an era where there were some real dominant forces up there at the top of the division. Not everyone gets to be the champion. Not everyone gets to be a Hall of Famer or an all-time great. But, like, I don't know, man. If you're Paul Felder, I think you got to look back on what you did and be pretty happy about it.
Yeah. And I think that when you look at some of his career, you see a guy who, like, some of these losses, I'm not saying that he wouldn't have won them under different circumstances, or saying that he would have won them under different circumstances or anything, but you see some company guy stuff happening in the last couple of years for Paul Felder. Like, hopping in and taking that Rafael Dos Anjos fight is one. You know, going up to welterweight, fighting Mike Perry there, like, that's another one. Like, that's, he's got that win over Charles Oliveira, which I think a lot of people would be pointing to and saying, like, you know, hey, this, a lot of fighters, as soon as Charles Oliveira becomes champ, and you're, I think Mike, Paul Felder was the last guy to beat him, that's when they would seize on that thing. And Paul Felder's explanation of his retirement and everything, and how he felt like, how he just did not have that in him to do, I think kind of tells you that he's making the right choice at the right time. And yeah, for the right reasons, really. Like, I agree with the assessment that because of the situation and because of the way he explained it, it does feel like this is one of those retirements that's going to stick. And honestly, I think he has done himself so many favors as a commentator, and people have gotten to know him and like him so much in that role as a commentator, that it makes them more favorably inclined to his, to like a rosier view of his career when they start talking legacy at the end of it. Like, yeah, sure, fine. You didn't win the big one. You didn't win the championship. You didn't win them all. Had some wins, some lost some there toward the end of the career, but you're always a fun guy to watch, and we just have a favorable opinion of you in general. Like, that makes for a strong legacy, I think.
Yeah, one of the things that I admire about Paul Felder, and have talked to him a couple times, and like, he's just kind of a straight shooter in terms of being honest about his place in the division and what he's been through and kind of his motivations as a fighter and how difficult it has become as he has gotten older to continue to get back and train as hard as he wants and compete at the highest level. I'm just going to read a couple of quotes here, looking at the MMA Junkie story here by Danny Segura and Ken Hathaway. Here's Felder's quote. He says, I don't think I'm going to get to the belt. I think this is the first time when I finally think, after those two losses in a row, watching guys like Jacare break their arm, watching guys like Cowboy fight five more fights past when I think they should, and I'm like, I'm not going to be that guy. I won't be that guy that fights past his expiration date, and I think it's here. I think it's a touch early, but I'd rather be a touch early than a touch late. And which is, you know, a good thing to hear a fighter say. And he goes on to say, I don't want to get hit in the head anymore. I don't have any major health concerns right now, but I've been in some battles, and I've been in more battles than I've been in the octagon, than I've been inside the room, the training room. He also talks about how it's been a long time since he's, or several months at least, since he has been in an MMA gym and hasn't really felt the fire to do it. And then he went and tried to hit pads for five rounds and said that he didn't enjoy himself and didn't feel the spark to, you know, get back into training or get back into doing it at the level that he wants to do it. And so, like, for all of those reasons, it seems like a good choice for Paul Felder, and one from a guy that I think we can all respect for a lot of those reasons. And so, like, he's still going to be around the sport. He'll still be in the broadcast booth in many ways. Aside from the fighting, we will still get to experience like the best of what Paul Felder has to bring to this sport. And so I'm happy for the guy, man. I hope that everything works out for him.
Yeah. Well, and some of that stuff that he said by way of explanation, like, I think he said something along the lines of like how, like, his mother or somebody had said, like, hey, if you can't train MMA or train fighting stuff every day, you'll go crazy. And he was like, I haven't trained it for like 3 months and I feel fine. And that's like, that maybe is a good sign to me that when I don't feel like I absolutely need it in my life and I feel like I'm interested in doing other things, that is probably a good sign to you. And it's rare that we see somebody who has the kind of self-awareness and the honesty with themselves to say some of this stuff, to be like, hey, I don't think I'm going to get the belt now. You know, yeah, I beat Charles Oliveira, but he's not the same guy now as he was when I beat him. You know, I could still talk myself into thinking that I can beat absolutely anybody on any given night. But if I'm honest with myself, I go, I don't love this the way I once did. And if you're not going to be all the way in this and fully committed to this, it's better to be all the way out. I also think, though, that it helps that he has this option. He can be like, hey, I'm going to retire, but still use the cachet I have built up in this sport as a different kind of career. Yeah. And granted, it's not like you know, being a UFC commentator is the most secure form of employment. You know, that was one of Brian Stan's complaints about it, and that is still like the way they approach it. But he's really good at it. He was seemed like a natural at it right away. And so he has this sort of fallback option that a lot of other guys don't have, where he could be like, you know what, I think I'll just do the thing where I sit there and I talk about the fights and I get paid to do that instead and nobody punches me in the face. And a lot of other guys would love to have that option, but don't really have it. And, you know, but this is the thing, like when we were talking before about how fighters make too big a deal about endings in career, especially thinking about their legacy and like the legacy they're going to leave. They're always thinking about what, like, I can't go out on that loss, or I can't go out on this bad stretch, because they think that the way it ends has such a big effect on the way we see them. And we think, you know, maybe that is not quite the case. Even though he's going out, you know, on two losses in a row, you can't really tell me that this isn't a happy ending in a way. You know, like Paul Felder goes out with like respected by his peers, respected by the fans and the media, being able to sit there and to have decided on his own terms, and then to be able to sit there and explain it to everybody in a way where we go, yeah, man, that makes sense. And like, we're impressed at like the eloquence and honesty with which you're able to talk about it. Like, that is a happy ending. Even if he lost two straight at the end, that's not really what we're going to remember so much.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think it's absolutely a happy ending. Next question comes from Tracy Dickinson, who writes, "While I'm sad to see Paul Felder retire for purely selfish reasons, but I am very happy for him at the same time, I'm hoping this means that we'll see him commentating even more. He and Michael Bisping have become my favorite duo behind the desk. They're both extremely knowledgeable, quick-witted, will call it like they see it, and play off each other really well, in my opinion. Do you have a current favorite duo or trio of the commentating teams that we've been seeing lately for the UFC?" The evolution of the UFC broadcast team has really been incredible, to think of where we've come from, you know, from back in the day when it used to be Goldberg and Rogan pretty much every week out. And now we have a fleet of able, you know, either active or very close to active fighters who all kind of bring a slightly different flavor to the commentary booth. And I just think more than anything, almost like the roster itself, the UFC has sort of an embarrassment of riches in terms of being able to switch it up with all of these different voices, all of these different opinions, all of these different approaches to being in the booth, from someone who's very technical like Dominic Cruz to all the way up to you know, someone like Michael Bisping, who's going to have a little bit more fun and be as honest as he wants to be, and then to a guy like Daniel Cormier, who is, you know, clearly loving every second of being on the broadcast and wants to have as much fun with it as he can. And I'll be honest with you, there's no current fighter that shows up in the broadcast booth that I dislike. I think that they all do a really good job.
Yeah, I agree. And that there's, and we're still giving more of them a chance. Like Bilal Muhammad got a chance to be on the analyst desk and everything. Like, there are still other ones who can do this, who can fill this role and everything. And you're right that to be able to have so many people come from the fighter side of it and be able to do this thing. I really like, though, using retired fighters like Paul Felder and Michael Bisping. Yeah. Just because I think, like, when you use current fighters, there's just so many opportunities for, I don't even want to say conflict of interest, because that sounds a little more official than it is, but just like, they're still really enmeshed in that world, man. And there's still going to be stuff that affects the way that they commentate. Just, it's going to naturally come up. And when people are more like, they're all the way out of the game, and they know that. Daniel Cormier is, you know, is another good example. And they're enjoying that fat and happy retired life, and can just focus on just doing this. I feel like that's better for everybody. But I also feel like when you start to think about the embarrassment of riches that you have as far as like color commentary and the expert analysis coming from fighters who can be broadcasters, and then you got, you know, two good, you know, play-by-play guys that you can choose from, doesn't it seem more and more like the odd man out here is Joe Rogan, who I know a lot of people just absolutely love. Fighters love Joe Rogan, and he's been there as a commentator for some of the sport's biggest moments, and his calls are sort of just like burned into the collective memory of this sport. But these days, as a Spotify multimillionaire, it seems like it's very clear that when you have all these other people doing a ton of research and they're very excited to come in here and work as commentators, and he is the one guy who's doing like the least of that, who seems to bring like the least rigorous preparation to some of these. Like, he's just kind of going to show up and beat Joe Rogan, which maybe the, you know, the UFC and ESPN love that and they're totally fine with that. But when you have so many of these other people who have like actual fighting experience and are good broadcasters and are also like, this is their job now and they're really working hard at it and not like, you know, just showing up, rolling in on Saturday morning to do it and then roll back out and make hundreds of millions of dollars at their podcast. Like, this is it for them. I feel like we get more out of that these days than we get out of Joe Rogan.
Yeah. And it feels like the commentary in general has entered a different era. Like, when you get Joe back on the broadcast team and he immediately starts doing all of the Roganisms that he is so known for over the years, talking about how everyone is tired and everyone is rocked and there's nothing he likes,
Chad.
Nothing he likes more than a series of leg kicks, and every submission is a life ender. It's pretty jarring now to see it and to remember, like, oh, this is like the kind, this is what he does every time. This is the thing. These are the things that he does. But I honestly think with Joe, who is a color commentator that I feel like I've lived several lives with, throughout these UFC broadcasts and have had a fleet of different opinions about over the years, I kind of feel like the million-dollar question with him is going to be, does he even want to keep doing it? Like, now that he has the $200 million in Spotify money, now that maybe his stand-up career isn't as tethered to the UFC as it was at one time. Because remember, like, Rogan essentially used to make a week of it, man. Like, he would go wherever the broadcast was going to be.
Yeah.
He would do stand-up in the town on Thursday or Friday, and then he would do the UFC on Saturday, and then he would, like, go on to the next one. He doesn't have to do that anymore for a lot of different reasons, the Spotify reason probably being the most significant. But, like, he has been doing it for so long, and his professional circumstances have changed so much. You can tell he still loves the sport. I think he still likes to be around the sport. But is he going to want to keep going to every UFC pay-per-view, wherever it may be, and sit there for 6 hours and commentate on the event? It doesn't always feel like he does. And so I think he will, knowing how the UFC will stick with a format and just pound it into the ground years after it probably should, I wouldn't expect anyone to like relieve Joe Rogan of his duties anytime soon, especially a guy who seems as well liked and respected and a guy who has quote unquote paid his dues with the company, et cetera, has a lot of loyalty there. But I think the ultimate question will be like, how long does he want to keep doing it? And at some point, will he be like, you know what? I'm going to stay in Texas and watch on TV.
Yeah. And I mean, I think you're right. I don't think it's anybody calling up Joe Rogan to be like, you know what? We're going to give you a gold watch and we're going to send you on your way. I think it's going to be up to him to decide that, you know, maybe I would enjoy it more and have more fun watching the fights, talking about it live on my podcast with my friends, and sitting there with a big ass cigar telling them about how all those big muscles require a whole lot of oxygen.
That's right. You know? Yeah. Yeah, in your
and they all owe their careers for being on this podcast, so they're going to be like, you're totally right, man.
He is rocked, Joe. You're absolutely right. Next question this week comes to us from noted Hollywood character actor Robert Zadar, who writes, "If Kayla Harrison can't finish out her PFL contract and make 145 by New Year's, is Spencer versus Dumont the last we'll see of the UFC women's featherweight division?" Of course, Norma Dumont gets the split decision victory over Felicia Spencer on Saturday night in the women's 145-pound weight class. We talked about Chris Cyborg and her win over Leslie Smith over in Bellator at the top of the show. We always get these questions, and it always sort of perennially feels like the women's featherweight division in the UFC is hanging on by a thread. But I guess in specific answer to this question, I would say two things. Number one, the thing that I always come back to is like, why? Why would you kill off the women's featherweight division? It's not really costing you any money. The only thing that it is allowing you to do is to have Amanda Nunes run around with those two belts and be the champ and give her an extra little piece of flair that you can use to promote her if you want to. And when there is a featherweight title matchup that makes sense and she wants to take it, you can book it. So it's not like there, I don't see really any drawbacks to having a women's featherweight division in the UFC, except that people look at it and think like, oh, it's a joke, there's no rankings. But aside from like actual utility, there's nothing, as far as I know, keeping you from having a women's featherweight division in the UFC. So I don't really see the point of killing it. The second thing I would say is I wouldn't doubt Kayla Harrison on any front, man. If Kayla Harrison wants to make 145 pounds, if she can come to a financial agreement with the UFC, she absolutely can do it. And I think that she comes in and is a force at that weight immediately. And so I wouldn't doubt her on any question or accomplishment in this sport. And we'll see what happens.
Well, first of all, yeah, we do appreciate hearing from deceased character actor here, Robert Zadar, who I want to point out was known for having his enormous face and jaw. And then when he played one of the bad guy characters in Tango and Cash, they decided to just name that character Face. So yeah. That's fun.
Also, that's if I'm not thing. Mistaken, the star of the Maniac Cop series, which was one of my favorites back in, you know, late teens, early 20s. You get a bunch of guys together to drink 40s and watch Maniac Cop, you're going to have a good time.
I'm looking right now at the IMDb page for Maniac Cop 3, Badge of Silence.
That's how you do it circa 1992, my guy.
That feels like a title you came up with just throwing darts at a dartboard.
I remember the end of one Maniac Cop movie, not to do any spoilers, but like the main character guy dies and they put him in a coffin and lower him down into the ground and they toss his badge down there on top of the coffin. And the last scene of the movie, his fucking zombie hand punches up through the top of the coffin and grabs the badge and pulls it down into the coffin. And I was just like, yes, sign me up for more Maniac Cop, and also get me another 40 of this Mickey's malt liquor.
The poster for Maniac Cop 2 has the tagline, "You have the right to remain silent, ... forever."
Yes. See? So I'm telling you.
That's what you're dealing with. Yeah, I mean, I guess the thing is, just kind of like you're saying, there being no good reason to do away with it. Like, right now, if you do away with the women's featherweight division, I mean, maybe you lessen the burden a little bit on the matchmakers, you take away a little bit of a headache. But it also, I don't think if you're the UFC, you really want to send the message, we're closing up shop on this women's division, we decided to give up on it. Like, you just, if you can help it, you don't want to send any sort of message that you are shrinking at all, or like pulling away, or like contracting like from some of this stuff. Plus, why, like, one of the biggest selling points you have right now whenever Amanda Nunes fights is going to be saying two division champ. Why take a belt off the poster if you don't have to? If it's not causing you any big headaches, if it's not causing you any trouble to just keep it around for a while. And I think, I mean, as far as the idea of like Kayla Harrison finishing out her PFL contract, making 145 at the end of the year, if I'm Kayla Harrison, I'm going, you know what? I'm going to hang out here in PFL for one more of these seasons. I'm going to cash another one of those giant ass $1 million novelty checks at the end of the year. And in the meantime, I'm going to let Amanda Nunes get a little bit older, maybe a little bit complacent before I even think about coming over there. And then by the time I do, I'm on some Michael Chandler shit, really negotiating a good deal for myself with the UFC because they actually want me. They actually see me as a really good pickup that they have to go and get and negotiate for. And then when I come in there, I want to be ready for them, because if they do go and pay big money for you, similar to like the Michael Chandler thing, it's a good chance that they're going to want to make that Amanda Nunes fight pretty quickly after that. So yeah, man, hang out. I'm going to get better at this stuff, cash that check, and then go over there when the timing is right.
I'm going to put these next two questions together. This one from Alex Penny, who writes, can we get some big ups for your boy, Big Ben Rothwell? And then this one from Mr. Weidman, who writes, he's still my beast boy. So, yeah, Ben Rothwell. Well,
you forgot the subject line on this one from Mr. Weidman, which hype says, train. Hype train stopped for maintenance.
Yeah, there you go. Big Ben Rothwell in the featured prelim on Saturday beats newcomer, the beast boy, Chris Barnett. Second round guillotine choke submission. Ben, you and I weren't early adapters on the Beast Boy. We have recently have our coats pulled to the existence of the Beast Boy, and so we've only recently begun the film study about Chris Barnett, but we liked what we saw from a lot of different standpoints, and it's kind of a shame. You know, I'm not going to say I wanted Big Ben Rothwell to lose here, because everyone knows the Dark Wizard is one of the favorites of the co-main event podcast. But it would have been cool to see the Beast Boy, Chris Barnett, do his trademark post-win dance out there in the octagon. And we were denied that by this guillotine choke win from Ben Rothwell.
First of all, you mentioned the Dark Lord, Ben Rothwell. I like how even when he has to wear that Venom kit, he's going to do what he can with it by wearing just like the hood up on the thing and not putting his arms in. And he's just going to wear it as a cape, essentially, yeah. when he has yeah. to walk to the ring. Like you know, you can take the Dark Lord robes away from Ben Rothwell, but he is going to make your fight kit into his Dark Lord robes if he has to. And I appreciate that. Also, though, man, that is a tough draw when you go, okay, we're going to bring you into the UFC. You have all these matchups they want to make for you that kind of fall apart. You're supposed to fight kind of end of May kind of thing. And then, okay, how about this? Why don't you just fight Ben Rothwell, man? Like, you're giving up like 9 inches of height or something like that. You know, he's super fucking experienced at a really high level of heavyweight MMA. And then why don't you just go in there and see how you do against Ben Rothwell? That's a tough welcome to the UFC for Chris Barnett.
UFC debut against Ben Rothwell would be rough for anybody.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, obviously the Beast Boy comes out on the short end here. Hopefully we get to see him again. Here's the next question here from Adam Andra, who writes, I only have a minute to write this before work, but if nobody's asked you, can you address the recent Josh Fabbia interview where he slandered just about everybody and accused the NAC of having Diego Sanchez fix a fight? That seems like an incredibly serious accusation to throw out there. Lord willing, and the creek don't rise, this is the last time we'll have to talk about Josh Fabbia
on any of
the
co-main
event podcast products. I enjoyed the story out today. First of all, people are still having Josh Fabbia on their podcasts, which goes to show you how many MMA fight podcasts there are out there and how many people are like, God, we got to have somebody on the show this week. Maybe we can get Fabbia. And he comes on there in this most recent appearance, says a number of things about Diego Sanchez, not all of which I will recap. But perhaps most hilariously says, it's clear now that Diego Sanchez was just taking advantage of me. To which I say, LOL, motherfucker.
First of all, you mentioned the people out there still having like Josh Fabian and having him as a guest. Kind of makes a strong argument for your podcast never ever interviewing guests, if you ask me. Because that's one thing you don't have to worry about on the CME is that we will up and interview Josh Fabbia. This stuff that he says in here, for one thing, people pointed this out a lot on Twitter after this came out, but they are not wrong that a lot of this feels like classic abuser behavior, because he seems like Diego Sanchez finally splits from him after everybody can see that this guy is a charlatan and a fraud and taking advantage of Diego Sanchez. And then when Diego Sanchez finally says, all right, you know what, I'm going to split from him, the first thing this guy thinks to do is use all this like private, personal, confidential information that he feels like he has gained from Diego Sanchez. And who knows how much of it is even true. But even if you assume that it is true, you're like, man, if you're airing some of this stuff about him, I got to assume he told you that in confidence. And your first thing you think to do is to weaponize that information against him. And that is just a major red flag, like major just scumbag behavior on Fabia's part. Plus, a lot of this stuff where, like, he's going to talk about, like, oh, Diego Sanchez presented himself to me as if he was just, like, a regular, normal person, which, first of all, A, no, he has never done that in his entire life for any of us. But then he's like, his counter to that is like, oh, yeah, then we're talking to a lawyer, and he mentioned, like, being in special education in school, and I'm like, oh, wow, that's a major, like, warning sign to me. And you're like, what the fuck is wrong with you, man? What the fuck are you talking about? Like, all this stuff that he's saying, you just, like, I don't know if you're the person interviewing him, how do you sit there and listen to him do this stuff? Like the stuff where he's talking about the Nevada State Athletic Commission leaning on Diego Sanchez to get him to throw the fight against Michael Chiesa, that is just grade A nonsense, just lunatic sand stuff, just to see what, like, open your mouth just to see what comes out. There's so many ways that is wrong. and makes no sense. And I can't decide if it's more worrisome that this guy might actually believe some of this stuff, or if it's more worrisome if he's just, if he knows it's all bullshit and he's just doing it just to attack everybody around and just tear down anything he sees. It's absurd, man.
If I could make a deal with the devil and in exchange for not having to talk about Josh Fabia anymore, we had to talk about the Paul brothers every week for the rest of our lives, I would do it. I would do it.
So in this scenario, the devil, like, he doesn't want your soul or anything.
Mm-hmm. When you say the devil, I assume you mean Al Pacino.
He just wants to make us just like do something we don't want to do.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of benign activity for the devil, honestly.
It's a low stakes exchange for him.
All right. I don't know if the devil really engages in those, but okay.
Next question this week comes to us from Philip Schmid, who writes, after the last UFC, I was asking myself, is Jared Vandera becoming one of our guys? Free-flowing fighting style with an everyday man's gut. Check. Gigantic cut leaking doesn't stop him. Check. Rocking the interview, he's kind of big. Check. I'm interested. Let's all just stay away from his social media. I mean, that's just...
Vandera?
Is it Vandera or Vendera? I thought they were saying Vendera on the broadcast.
Okay.
Jared V, gets a victory over Justin Taffa on Saturday. Heavyweight, you know, the good kind of heavyweight fight, I guess. These guys are out there throwing them thangs for 15 minutes. And after Big Jared V gets warmed up and gets a little cut on his head, he's out there throwing elbows and kicks and all kinds of stuff. I guess this is enjoyable to me. I mean, we can't just let everybody be one of our guys, but I'm intrigued. We're going
to need to know a little more. Yeah.
We're going to need to keep a close eye. Yeah, but I'm intrigued. I like what we see so far.
A question that somebody was asking me in my mailbag this week was, if your opponent has a big leaking cut in his head and you get kicked in the balls and you get your 5 minutes to recover, is it even more to your benefit to take the full 5 minutes and just stand there and let the guy bleed? You know, I don't know how much blood is coming out of there, but like, if they can't fix it if they're not allowed to go in there or like the cut man and fix it, if he just has to stand there and bleed, maybe he starts to get a little woozy, you know, maybe the blood gets in his eyes a little bit. Maybe something like he just has to stand there and deal with that while you walk around and take your full five. Like, is that the best argument we've ever heard for taking the full five?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. You're just hoping he passes out from blood loss,
yeah,
and then maybe mm-hmm. you're declared the TKO winner. I guess.
It's like they're not allowed to come in there and give him a juice and a cookie, you know? Like, he's just got to stand there and bleed.
All right, we got time for a few more here. This one from Tim, he writes, so why hasn't anyone ever told me that if I wanted to escape ground positions, I can just spin out of them on my head, like Alves did? This is the perfect 2021 MMA highlight. Rafael Alves on the ground essentially does a breakdancing head spin to get himself back up to his feet. And
yeah,
exactly the kind of thing that you can put on Instagram or Twitter and people can watch in GIF form, and is the prototypical 21st century 2021 MMA highlight.
Yeah, it's where the Granby roll meets the just like, let's lay some cardboard out on the sidewalk, get the boombox out, and do some classic breakdancing. It's like the perfect marriage of those two things. The point where you're going to see that gif a whole lot from a like fight that's, I believe, is the curtain jerker on this one, first prelim, and a lot of people are going to see that and be like, oh, okay, that was awesome. That dude who did it is awesome. They won't even look into it enough to realize he lost the fight.
Yeah, that's right. Unanimous decision loss. Next question this week comes to us from Neil in Northern Ireland, who writes, seems like the upkick has had something of a resurgence with a few recent instances of it being used to change fights, the most recent being Liam McCourt at the weekend. So you can tell he's from Northern Ireland here. At the weekend, he says, who upkicked Jhené Harding and shortly after finished the fight with a triangle choke. Cue Ben shouting, jiu-jitsu!
Jiu-jitsu!
There you go. Had we all got a little too complacent about up kicks and what they can do? And if so, do you think there are any other moves out there just waiting for their own resurgence? We have seen some up kicks in the last few weeks here. I would say that's probably a coincidence. That's probably a good example of coincidence in action. But yeah, man, never forget the up kick. You can get kicked in your face.
Seen some people get fuck around and get themselves in trouble up kicking somebody who is technically a downed opponent.
That's true.
So you want to watch out. You know what I want to see make a resurgence? Picture this. You got somebody, they take you down, they're on top of you in guard, you got your guard closed, and then you open it just enough to heel kick the shit out of their kidneys.
Okay. Remember that move? Since we saw that. Yeah, it's a Hoyce Gracie original.
Just lay there on your back, staring up at the ceiling, just slamming that heel over and over again, like into their love handles, basically, and hoping for the best. That's what I want. I want to see. Bring it back.
Bringing that back.
Bring it back. And then if you're the guy on top, I assume you're just there going body, body, head. You know, that's right. Just all day long.
Next question this week comes to us from Michael Heelan, who writes, I've never watched a season of The Ultimate Fighter. First of all, that's amazing. Then he writes, most of the criticisms I hear are that it is tired, unoriginal, and a retread of all the other seasons. If I'm not carrying that baggage, is it worth a watch? He says, additional note, I'm not overly fond of giving the UFC as an organization my money or any unnecessary viewership. Apologies to its new ownership, Ben. I don't even know that I can answer this, because a world where I have not seen an episode or a season of The Ultimate Fighter is so completely foreign to me that I don't even know if I can imagineer my way into it.
Yeah. First of all, this made me go and look up to see how our Endeavor stock is doing. We're down to $28.83 at the moment, Chad.
It's plummeting.
Yeah. I'm going to be like one of those dudes in like the market crash in the 20s or whatever, just taking an old-timey revolver out of the cigarette case and just putting it into my mouth as soon as I see that thing drop below 25. I don't know if I can handle it, man. I don't know if I can hack that world.
That's bleak.
But honestly, it is hard to imagine somebody who is in this world enough to email the Co-Main Event podcast but has not ever seen any Ultimate Fighter stuff. And honestly, I'm tempted to say, maybe it would be worth a watch if you've never seen it. Maybe the first time through, it'd be a fun time. Even if it's them just still doing the same thing they've been doing since 2005. If it's all new to you, maybe it'd still be fun. But a lot of it is just dependent on who they have on the season and what the dynamics end up being. But I mean, I will say, even if you haven't seen The Ultimate Fighter, you've seen a reality show, right? Yeah. Because that is like it's not going to be completely foreign territory to you. You're going to recognize some of the stuff they're doing. You're going to kind of recognize like, oh, there are people here because they're actual good fighters and somebody has to win this damn thing and then hopefully turn into something afterwards. And there are also people here because there's just a bunch of people locked in a house and we want somebody to stir things up and be interesting to watch on TV. Every season has those. And so, you're going to recognize that if you watch the season of reality TV.
The question is, if you've never seen The Ultimate Fighter before, do you watch the new season or do you go back and check out some greatest hits? Would you watch the first season of The Ultimate Fighter? Would you watch season five with Nate Diaz? Or do you wait and you start right in with season 35,364, which I think is the one that's about to air?
I think I would start with this one. Give yourself a chance. Start with this one. See what they got when they bring it back. And because, first of all, you definitely do not want to go back and watch the first season, because that stands out to me as like the realities, like among all reality shows I've seen, that's the season of one where you can tell like they are making this shit up literally as they go.
Yeah.
They have one concept of how it's going to work in the beginning, and by the end, they're clearly rethinking that concept. And it's just like cobbled together ideas from other reality shows. Not all of it's worked very well in this fighting show. Like, if you are going to go back and watch one, go back and watch one from a little bit later, at least, where they have some of their shit figured out. But, like, I think I'd start with this one. Plunge yourself into the current world of The Ultimate Fighter. See where we're at. Then if you like it and you feel like you have not yet had your fill afterwards, come on back to us. We'll give you some recommendations after that.
Next question this week comes to us from Shaggy, who writes, Do we have to make three rosy superlatives for every pre-fight bio? You know, the one that pops up when the fighter is getting jelly on their face. Yeah, some fighters have great resumes, but when the third bio point is BJJ purple belt, or second highest strikes absorbed, or two fight win streak, can't we just put something fun like 8-4 chalupas in 1 minute, or fourth most nut shots in UFC history? What do you guys think of the UFC always making lemonade out of lemons with the pre-fight bios? I will say this, Ben. The UFC has been doing this since I started watching fights. I remember it being one of the first things that I noticed about the UFC broadcast. Because back in those days, I was, there were far less people on the roster, and I legitimately did know everything about them. And I would watch these pre-fight bios and be like, huh, that's one way to put it, I guess, when you're out here saying, like, he's won two of his last five. And it's just like, yeah, this dude is on a three-fight losing streak. But I guess you could say it the other way. It was one of the first things that tipped me off to the notion that when you watch a UFC broadcast, you are watching a thing that is controlled by the promotion, by the company. And just, so it's not like you are getting a journalistic, by the book, unbiased accounting of what is happening in the fight you're about to watch. And I guess from a promotional standpoint, I could understand why they wanted to do it that way. Why they, it's better to say this person is really rolling after their two fight win streak, rather than like, this person kind of sucks. They lost their first four fights in the UFC. But at the same time, like, it's just a reminder that you are watching a certain interpretation of reality, and it's the interpretation that the company wants you to see.
Yeah. No, I'll never forget watching the first Randy Couture Vitor Belfort fight, when the things listed under Vitor Belfort's name when he entered the cage, one of them was no known weaknesses.
Yeah.
Like, treating it as if he were a character in a superhero cartoon. Hails from parts unknown, no known weaknesses. He may have them, they have not been discovered yet. That kind of stuff, I went, even as like a young and somewhat naive viewer back then, going, huh, that's interesting. But you know what? The thing that I really love is when you go to the UFC website and you look up a fighter's fighter page on there, and they have their recent record in the UFC. They have some cool looking graphs about how their strikes per minute and takedowns defended and stuff like that. But if you scroll down, there's a Q&A sort of portion where it's what do you do for training? What do you feel like your best attributes are? What are some of your favorite moves? And at least the way it is entered on the UFC website, it looks like almost no editing goes into those at all. It looks like they have those guys fill out a form via email or something, send it back, and they'll just copy and paste it without reading it. Because sometimes the stuff will be like, I don't know, man. I like kickboxing, train 2-3 times a day, stuff. And it's just like somebody pointed out that I think it was even our guy, the Beast Boy, Chris Barnett, that one of the attributes he listed in his favor was personality. They meant fighting attributes, Chad.
Yeah.
But if he says if you put personality on the form, it's putting it on the teleprompter for Ron Burgundy. They will put it on there. Whatever you tell them, they will put on the damn website there.
All right, getting close to the end here, but here's one from Darcy, the mail girl, who writes, if an Invicta event happens on Access, does it make a sound? So you had Invicta FC 44 over the weekend on Access TV, its new landing spot. After it left the fightpass.com main event, Karina Rodriguez captures the flyweight title. And, we talked about when Invicta made the decision or the announcement that it was going to leave Fight Pass, that the relationship there always seemed like sort of a double-edged sword for Shannon Knapp and Invicta, that it's great to be on Fight Pass, or at least was at the time, because you had this association with the UFC and a lot of people had that service and would probably watch you on there just because you were on the UFC streaming service. But it kind of meant that you were also just going to be giving all your top talent to the UFC when they came of age in your promotion. And so you move over to Access TV, which I'm sure gives you more autonomy and may overall be a better broadcast deal. I don't know. But in this day and age, when you got Bellator and the UFC and Ryzen and ONE FC all happening constantly, what do you think? Is it hard to remember Invicta when it's happening over on Access TV these days?
I think the thing is, Invicta just needs to make sure more people know that you can stream it on YouTube.
Oh,
that it's not just on Access
TV. I didn't know that.
yeah, I think that that's just a messaging issue for Invicta to let everybody know that you can, like, it's on Access TV, but if you don't have that, you can stream it on YouTube.
All right, that's an important thing to know. This might be the last one from Jake, who writes, subject line, Joe Rogan versus Jake Paul.
He writes,
it makes so much sense for Jake Paul to fight Joe Rogan in MMA. Both would bring huge audiences. Jake Paul wants to get into MMA, and I'm not sure who would be the favorite. Why is no one talking about this as a possibility? Tons of money to be made for both sides. Jake, I love you, buddy. Thanks for emailing the podcast. We appreciate it. Are you trying to get us killed by our listeners? Like, this email encompasses both of the topics that enrage the co-main event podcast listenership the most. Both Jake Paul and Joe Rogan's audience and reach as a podcaster and all of his opinions. Are you trying to get them to come for us with pitchforks and torches by sending us
this
question?
What I want to know, Chad, I want to know, what did you get in this deal with the devil that you made where you promised to read this question on the podcast?
Well,
what did you receive?
This is the kind of thing that the devil would pull, right? Like, I make the deal with the devil so we don't have to talk about Josh Fabia anymore. And then the next week, the Trillers, Books, Joe Rogan, and Clarence Paul in an MMA fight. That's what would happen. That's how the devil would get us.
Special guest referee Wesley Snipes. Book it.
I mean, they probably would make a lot of money, though.
And, you know, then you'd have, like, Nicki Minaj as the musical act, and we all get out of there having blown $10 million somehow. And the next thing you know, we get an email from Triller saying, we know you watched it and you didn't pay us. We'll give you a month. We'll give you a month to make it right.
This is your house. Your one chance.
Yeah.
Well, we're just going to leave it there. We're going to end things on that note. Remember, if you want to hear more from us, we'll be over all week over on the Patreon page, patreon.com/comainevent. We got the live chat on Wednesday, the movie club on Thursday, where Little Ben Folks' Christmas dreams finally come true. We're going to watch Tender Mercies for the movie club. And then the week after that, we get to watch whatever I want. And then Friday for the Power Hour. We'll be doing all that stuff over at the Patreon page. Feel free to join the team, patreon.com/comainevent. Thanks for listening. As for right now, though, we are done. We are through. We are out.
Assuming you haven't watched Tender Mercies yet. Is that what you're saying?
No. I mean, if I had watched it, would I be able to even get through this broadcast? Because of my overwrought emotions, I would have to bring a tissue. I'd be sitting over here crying. So I haven't watched it yet.
It's a beautiful film about a country singer. Things he goes through.
I'm actually going to watch the movie with Lady Gaga and Bradley Cooper instead. What's that one?
Don't you... You know what? Don't you fuck around. Not about Tender Mercies, Chad. You know? Not about this. There's no time for joking.
It's too important.
It's too goddamn important. I've been waiting for this for what feels like my entire life.